Okay, so what we have on the front is, if you were here 2 weeks ago, we kind of talked about this exact same thing, so I'm just kind of pushing us along the story arc that we talked about before. And so if you weren't here, you can kind of skim through this, and you have just like a really classic story arc up at the top with kind of six very typical elements of a story, and then underneath that on that line is essentially a plot line of the Bible and how that falls into those six elements, and then underneath that kind of where we are in our study today in chapter 5 and what you worked on this week. And just to kind of zoom in on last week when Lisa talked and you did the study, a lot of that dealt with the Noahic covenant and then the Abrahamic covenant. And just the idea, and this like is very elegantly placed, but because we just talked about this on Sunday also, that we have this faithful, promise-keeping kind of God. And so all these things are really aligning for us in our study. And then we talked last time also, if I had to kind of pinpoint like a whole Bible theme, I would say that it is that God is glorious and or that he reigns and loves us. And then you can go ahead and look at the next part and sort of our overarching thing that we're going to talk about today is that number one, and most of our time will be spent on that first section, this first section. But that we're going to be talking about this pattern of redemption that she talked about in the study. And so we'll spend a good amount of time on that. And then we'll kind of skim pretty quickly through the law for a holy nation and then the limitations of that law and then being a kingdom of priests and the limitations of the priests. And so Carter and I got married very quickly. We met for the first time like in August. And then we had our first date in December. We were engaged by March and married by July. And it was the kind of thing where, like, I had a literal list of, like, this is what I'm looking for in a man. And I was like, he's, you know, like, he's got all these things. And so we're good to go. What can I say? Like, this worked out for me very, very well. But if my kids ever tried to pull this, I think I would lose my mind. But the point I'm trying to say is that we had, like, this very climactic sort of moment in our marriage. And it was this big shift, this kind of rite of passage that happened, and I'm not like calling it a rescue necessarily, but it was like this kind of exodus from like singlehood to married life, from like a kind of youthful life to a more like full-fledged adulthood. It was a big change, a big sort of climax in my life that was exhilarating, but then after that, we definitely had to learn how to be in relationship, and we, like, came to find out there were a lot of things that we just didn't even know about each other, and so we had to kind of walk through that together and learn how to live together. We had to learn how to resolve conflict, and my, like, technique of never apologizing apparently is not a good way to resolve conflict. That we had to learn how to repent and resolve. We had to talk out finances and kids and all this stuff, like, unfolding in our life. And we see a lot of that in what we're talking about today, in the story of the Exodus, and then the Israelites learning how to be in relationship and live with God. And so as we're on this grand kind of story arc, we have this, what I would call, like, a meta narrative. And what we read in Genesis and Exodus and kind of these first building chapters are kind of these like micro story arcs that go all along this meta narrative. Does that make sense? And so you have like the story of Abraham, which he has his own little story arc. And you have the story of Moses, and he has his own. And Joseph has his own. And David has his own. And, you know, like all these different characters along the way or people along the way. And it's embedded in this larger arc and foreshadowing what we talked about the last time, that we have this grand climax and this grand resolution. And so in the pattern of redemption that Doctor is talking about this week, the plan was always for healed relationship. It was not just about this climactic, really beautiful thing that happens in the Exodus. It's always been about this healed relationship and learning to live together. It's not just about the wedding, it's about the marriage. And so another thing that I thought was really great that she talked about was when she discussed like the order of these things, that it's so important that the rescue happens first and then the rules for kind of engagement happen after that, and that every other religion in the world is a reverse of that, that you obey the rules and then you are saved. And the difference with Christianity is that you're saved first and then you learn how to and practice obedience after that. And the difference is, like, what we have in Christianity is an obedience motivated by relationship and love, as opposed to like self-interest or fear. And that's a pretty big relationship. A big difference. It allows relationship to happen. And what I think is also really interesting is that if you were here last year when we talked about Colossians, when we talked about the indicative and the imperative, this is really the exact same thing, just in narrative form. The idea of that Paul leads with this is who God is and then follows with commands, this is your response. And so what we have in this story is the exact same thing. You have this is what God does. He sets his people free, and then this is how you respond. Here is kind of the Ten Commandments after that. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Okay. And so I think that part of the thing that is so amazing about the Bible to me is that the content is remarkable, but his like artistry in writing it is also really remarkable. And I think that is like a reason for praise too, that this like consistency throughout the whole story and the order of the whole story, it's clear it's coming from a single author, and that this structure is really beautiful, that it's really symmetrical and creative. So let's kind of push into the rescue part of this pattern. And so that is, of course, when we talk about the escape and the Exodus. And Exodus is a big deal in the Bible because it's such a perfect picture of what we're talking about. It's such a perfect picture of rescue. It's such a perfect picture of being set free from bondage. That God's active hand in that freedom is really apparent in this story. And so it gets made much of in the Bible itself. And then afterwards, this kind of struggle of living with a holy God. And we talked about on Sunday the repetition of this, that with Abram and Sarai and these earlier plagues with Pharaoh. And so we see that kind of just repeated again in this really wonderful way. And so what I put underneath here, I'm not going to go through every single name on this list. This is a very pruned kind of family tree. But I just want us to trace kind of this line that we're going down. And so starting like last week with Noah, and then one of his sons was Shem. And then kind of there's this windy line because I cut out a bunch of stuff in there. But then you have Abraham and Sarah and Isaac and Jacob. And we're pushing down until you have your 12 patriarchs. And then Dinah, who is the one that was raped. And then Simeon and Levi come back to like avenge her. Rapist, and then coming through Levi, which we will come back to him when we talk about the priests, but then you have Miriam and I'm not even going to try to say the mother's name, but then you have Miriam and Aaron and Moses underneath them, and so you can see kind of the progression and how most of it is laid out, even though this is much simplified. And I like shamelessly put in a ton of Prince of Egypt pictures because I really like the knitting, and I let my kids watch it way too young. Because I remember watching it when I was like in high school or college. I was like, oh, I love that movie. That was great. It like popped up on Netflix and I was like, done. And then I go into the kitchen to make dinner and then they start killing babies. And my oldest is like, Mommy, what are they doing with the babies? And I was like, nah. And now they're scarred. So I think that like, I love the movie. I think it's really great. I think it gives like artistic picture to the story, but essentially, I mean, most of us probably know the story, but that you have this conflict, you have this long-standing problem that the Israelites are enslaved and oppressed in Egypt under Pharaoh, and they need a hero to rise up and rescue them. And so what I think is really fascinating about the Bible are these Christ types that you find, especially in the Old Testament, and Moses is such a classic Christ type. And so you can also look to like archetypal characteristics of just a hero. And both of them really fall in line with those characteristics. And so we'll just kind of skim through these real quick. But both of them like narrowly escape death by either Pharaoh or Pilate right after their birth. And so there's this kind of miraculous, oh, like you are a part of the story. You must be saved. We're going to push you kind of on your path. They were both raised by parents or a father who was not like their real father. And so you can think about Moses in the basket going to live in the palace, and you can think of Christ leaving his divine father to come be raised on earth. There is this really great like early anointing where there's a moment where you say like this character is different. There's something special about this one. And they get, so you can think about when Simba gets held up and like the mark on his forehead, you can think about Harry Potter's scar, you can think about like King Arthur pulling the sword out of the stone. There's almost always like something that happens like earlier in the story that's a mark for like future leadership. And so with Moses, I would say that like his burning bush moment is that for him. And then for Christ, his baptism with John the Baptist when the dove and the voice come down. And I think you can even think about like our baptism when we baptize children is can be kind of thought of in that same way, this anointing that you have been called. And then there's usually kind of a call and then either a refusal of the call or like a delay of the call. And that would, I would say for Moses when he talks about not being eloquent, and then Aaron is kind of, Yahweh allows Aaron to step into that spokesperson role, as a gracious concession. And I think with Jesus, I mean, like, this is a little bit different because he's God and he sort of knows who he is and he knows what his job is going to be. But when he says my hour has not come, I think that kind of classifies in that, category. And then there's a nadir. This is like a dire trial that's going to propel the hero into action. And I think that for Moses, that's when he has the murder, when he murders. And then for Christ, his 40-day temptation, I think kind of classifies as that. Usually in the wilderness. Usually that stuff happens in the wilderness. And then you would have the hero who steps into their call and heroically leads the nation out of bondage. And I do want to kind of just pause for a minute on the plagues, and especially the plague of the firstborn, because to read the story, like, it's difficult to like process that. And what I want to emphasize, if that is an issue for you, is that Pharaoh's refusal to relent over and over, and that Yahweh is trying to do this gently, let me try again and try again, and Pharaoh will not let it happen. And so there is warning, and given chance and chance after chance to escape without punishment. And he just withdraws that, until finally Yahweh like has to rip his people out of bondage. And so I think that that final plague on the firstborns is that kind of ripping his people out. And the issue that I have with that is that same issue of like Abraham, like being willing to sacrifice Isaac and just like, ugh, like, how do I, like, where do I put this? And the only way that I can kind of reconcile that is, like, that poignant kind of righteous indignation that I have over an innocent being killed is, like, magnified in Christ and the way that Yahweh and that God, like, allows his firstborn, his innocent, to be sacrificed. And that his heart broke and that he sympathizes with that. But it's still sad. And then I had to teach Beowulf probably more than I taught any other book. And by the end, I thought I was going to kill myself if I had to talk that way of Beowulf anymore. But it is very important, and so you can't really get around it in certain classes. And it's important because it's like what most people consider the first story in English. So it's Old English, but most people say this is the very first one. And Beowulf is interesting because you have like this collision of cultures that's happening. And so you have Christian missionaries that have come up basically from Rome all the way up through Europe, and they eventually get up to like these Anglo-Saxon people kind of in England. And so you have languages colliding. So you have this like French-Latin sort of mashup that is colliding with this Anglo-Saxon-German thing, and that's what English is. But you have the cultures colliding too. And so you have these like pagan ideas, this kind of revenge-minded like way of thinking of these Anglo-Saxon pagans, but in Beowulf it is spliced in with this idea of forgiveness and praising an almighty God. And so it's this weird mixture in the story, and it's a shift from what we see kind of the world over as this eye for eye, an eye for an eye kind of justice, that somebody has to pay for the crime. That historically people want victims to be compensated, that we are not okay that with people just getting away with things, that if you hurt someone, that you need to get hurt. So what you see in the story of Beowulf is this vicious revenge cycle, is that, like, you killed this person, so I'm killing you. So now you killed this person, so my brother's killing you. And so whole families, whole tribes are getting, like, wiped out because they don't have a way to solve that. And so when you see, in Beowulf, you see this idea of Wyrgild, and Wyr, the root, means man, and Gild, the root, means price. And so that means a man price. And it's this interesting solution to that problem. And a very, Christian idea that instead of everyone just killing back and forth incessantly, that you can value a life, and that's a whole, like, how much value you put on a life is a whole other issue that we're not going to talk about. But there is a mechanism to pay restitution, that justice can be served, but it can be served in an alternative way, that people's pain and damage, this is not invisible. We're not just like forgetting about this hurt that has happened to someone, but that oppressors might be publicly acknowledged and this oppression is not forgotten, but justice is executed, but in this alternative way for the tribe's survival, for their salvation. And Christianity presents forgiveness into this pagan culture, but it's married to accountability too. And so you're not letting go of either one of those. And to me, like, it solves this really remarkable paradox, that Christ can pay this Wyrgild for us and take on that scapegoat role and solve this kind of unsolvable problem. And all these gaping needs are filled by his life and death, that justice is served on him, that we can read this forward, like looking into him as the firstborn of all creation and his sacrificial and kind of representative death, that there is a high cost for penance and freedom. And we should see God's grace in that the lamb's blood was able to be spread over the doorpost at all, that any children were able to be saved. Like, that is grace, that he protects some. But like between the firstborn or a lamb, somebody, it's going to have to carry the punishment. And we see Christ answer both of those roles totally and fully in that he is the firstborn of all creation and he is the sacrificial lamb too. And that is, I think all of that is kind of difficult. But at the end of that, the Israelites walk out under the lamb's blood and they walk through the Red Sea. And it is like this crescendo kind of moment. You see God like actively, wildly rescue his people and bring them out of bondage. And then there's that beautiful moment where Miriam, who has seen Moses' story from like the basket until he's walking everyone through the Red Sea, and she sings her song of praise to God. And so then after that moment, after this kind of rescue climactic moment, what happens? They have to learn to live in relationship. And so Doctor in the study talks about obedience. And so I think that like they're living in relationship by communication and obedience. And she, this can be kind of tricky though. And so I don't like the idea that I think she talked about in Deuteronomy 28, that if you obey, he'll bless you and promote you. And if you don't, you'll be cursed. But we need to be careful with that idea because that can slip pretty easily into like health and wealth gospel. And we know that that is not a guarantee for us, that we also are taking up a cross and carrying that. And that there's a risky, like, adventure to our relationship with God, too, and that he is disciplining for good and all those things. And so, I mean, I think you just kind of hold those lightly and in balance that, you know, like, yes, you reap what you sow, that if you're going to make terrible decisions, hurtful decisions in your life, you're probably going to suffer some consequences, probably. But also that that he disciplines those he loves as a father. And so I just quickly want to touch on that this pattern of rescue and relationship, I think, relates to the covenants, too, and that, like, some of the covenants are conditional. And she says in the study that it's hard to hold God's, like, complete sovereignty in our relationship together, but God doesn't have trouble doing that. I'm not going to read through the covenants, but I just like to stick that in there sometimes, just a list of them, because sometimes we kind of throw that out. And I just want you to like have a framework, but these are the covenants that we're talking about. All right, so let's shift into a law for a holy nation. And knowing that this law that he gives is for protection, it's for cleansing, it's for atonement, it's to be able to like pass out worship to the local culture, and that it does, the law does restrict, but it's in order to promote flourishing. And I think we can think of our kids, or kids in general, to kind of illustrate that. And the law has implications for social justice, for aliens, for the body, and for the spirit, for interacting with insiders and interacting with outsiders. that it is a kind of social glue. You know, all these things are good things. But the sacrificial system that I listed in that chart right after that, which again, I'm not going to go through all that, but it's a rigorous setup. It is difficult and would have like run your life. So let's move into kind of the limitations of the law and if the law was ever intended to save. And so the law becomes big and nearly impossible. And what we see in the Old Testament is just this like spin cycle of, okay, the people are living in relationship with Yahweh, and then they slip into sin, and then Yahweh intervenes and kind of brings them back around into relationship again. There's this kind of revival, and that it just happens kind of over and over. And depending on like the good kings and the bad kings also are playing into that. But that is kind of, as we move along, that's what's happening. But the law alone could never save them. In large part, the law is showing my failings, which is a gracious gift so that I can know my need for Christ. And so I think Romans 7:13, the idea is that in order that sin could be shown as sin, and then the Matthew 9, that he came to call not the righteous but sinners. And so that, I think, is part of the limitations of the law. And then as we shift into the priests, that Levi is, as we, if you think back to that family tree, so coming out of one of those 12 patriarchs, Levi, this is where the priests are coming from. Originally, it was the firstborn, and then that shifts over to the Levites. For they are wholly given over to me from among the children of Israel, and instead of those that open the womb, all the firstborn of Israel I have taken them for myself. And Yahweh is their inheritance. And so they are different than the rest of the 12 tribes. And basically a priest's job is just as a leader and a teacher. And these priests were performing rites. They were administering sacraments. They were in charge of the sacrifices, singing psalms, and kind of maintaining the tabernacle and the temple. But most of all, what we can see them as is a mediator between God and man. And I don't want to, we're going to talk more about this next week when we talk about the tabernacle and the temple. And so I don't want to steal somebody else's stuff. But a lot of their role is that they are this go-between. And the beautiful thing is that with Christ, we don't need, he becomes our mediator. So we have direct access to God. Now, as far as like the priest limitations, the Levites themselves fall into sin, and when they go into exile, the priesthood almost disappears entirely, and so that was part of their limitations. But we can also see like their moral failure, like two main kind of things, moral failure and then like doctrinal failure. And she talks in the study about the story of the Good Samaritan and how these priests were not going to like cross the street to go deal with this man who is injured. And so part of that is that they would have become unclean if they're touching blood or touching a dead body, like that this is like going to get in the way of their own cleanliness. But also it's just it was an inconvenience. And so you see them kind of turning a blind eye on this person who is difficult, and you see law and convenience take priority over mercy and help. And like in the story, when the Good Samaritan does cross over and he picks him up and he puts, you know, like the bandages and he takes him and he gives money to the man, and it's a pretty like clean cut sort of situation. But sometimes in life, like, it's not clean cut when you're dealing with injured people, and that, you know, shocker that that addicted and anxious and depressed and damaged people are not always that fun to be around. And so in real life, it's very complicated and can be a long, long process to deal with someone's damage. and these people that you're trying to help, like, could blame you. They could just not respond to your advice and continue to make bad decisions. And I think that we can all probably think of somebody in our life who is an example of that, who just will not, like, start making better choices, who won't like help themselves to do better. And it's torturous to watch these people like backslide into, and I'm saying these people, like, that it might be us, to backslide into these bad lifestyle choices. But I do think that being in it for the long haul is such can be, even if they don't turn around, can be such a picture of just of God's redemption. And I don't really have time for a long illustration, but I had a girl that, I mean, I grew up with her. She was my best friend's little sister. And she was just always, I don't know, just always looking for drama. And her life, like, spun out of control. And there was a point where we were like, okay, let's just ask her to come be our roommate. And then she came to be our roommate. And then we were like, oh, you were definitely an alcoholic. And so, like, just to kind of skim past this, I mean, there was an intervention. She went to rehab. And this girl that was, like, so hard and just, like, crazy, like, in this abusive relationship and just insanity in her life, like, I saw her get married to the gentlest, most wonderful guy. She is, like, attends church now. But just this miraculous thing. She's, like, a decade sober at this point. And things that, like, sometimes when you look at people in their just set in their sin, it's hard to imagine that change can happen. And I think that I hope that all of us can kind of point to an example of where it does happen. Like, people can change, and He can redeem just really hard things. And I think it's also, when we're talking about moral failure, like, I think it's hard not to look at the Catholic priest situation right now, too, if we're talking about priests, and just how tragic that is, and how people who are in these power positions, we want them to step up and protect the weak, and we want them to step up and take care of these people, and sometimes that just falls apart, and it's just really sad. And so, underneath this, we have, like, the idea that these priests also had doctrinal failure, and I think we can look around in Christian culture and see that, too. So the happy kind of turn of this is that Christ is this beautiful fulfillment of this law with limitations, and He is a beautiful fulfillment of our great high priest, that he takes on both of those. And as we see, like, in the minor prophets, kind of the end of our text, right before we get to the Gospels, that that it is just, like, this setup for him. That in Malachi, you have this rebuke of the priests and Levites. That in Micah, we're asking, what does the Lord require? And we know that there's, like, this 400 gap between the prophets and when the Gospels start. But it is just, like, this, like, the tension is heightened right there in that moment. For Christ to enter in as our great high priest and our just lawgiver. And what we see in 1 Peter 2:9 is that He has done that, and so that now we can enter in as a part of this new priesthood. And I think that is really wonderful. And I have to say, like, I feel, when we're talking about, like, moral failure and stuff, like, I just feel really hypocritical. I've had a terrible week. And I've been just really mean to strangers on Facebook and picked fights with people that are on my team. I said some terrible things to our printer because it wasn't working when I fixed it just the day before. And terrible things to a lot of people this week. And, like, I think that I'm so thankful for Christ as that I can go and confess those things. And also, I'm really thankful for, like, the priesthood of the church, that this is a sweet, sweet, there are so many acts of mercy that have been visited on me this week when I deserved it the least, and people have come to take care of my kids so that I could write this talk, and people have brought me lunch and just had sweet, sweet things to say and listened to me be crazy and all those things, and it has been such a ministry to me to have these real needs met by the priesthood, to have these, like, good Samaritans come and care for me in this way when I don't deserve it. And so I think when we talk about God calling us a treasured possession or a kingdom of priests, and we say that He's paid the price for you, that sometimes that feels, like, far away and abstract, and it is, because it's spiritual and it's eternal, but it's also, like, right here, and it's hands and feet, and it's us. And I'm so thankful. So thank you, guys. I love y'all.